The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I'm one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts, Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm Michael Scavarla of Penn State.
We are happy to be back to talk with you some more about some entomology, entertainment, education topics. We've just finished up with DDT the last couple episodes. We had a murder hornet appreciation podcast in the middle of that, too. How are you guys doing? How's life? How's quarantine? We're at day 70-something, I think, at this point.
Does time matter anymore?
I think we can all agree at this point that time is over. We're over it. And it's canceled. Time is canceled.
Don't talk to me about that.
What about everything else? Everything else going okay?
Are you guys still talking about the murder hornet in the east? I got to talk about them yesterday, but nothing major happening over here other than the ordinary seasonal stuff.
Yeah, I've been getting a lot of tick questions. I've been getting some Asian giant hornet questions, which ultimately become European hornet questions, and rose slugs. I think I've gotten a smattering of rose slugs recently.
Oh, cool.
What about you, Mike?
We're Asian giant hornets all the time still. Everything's a European hornet or a southern yellow jacket, but I get 10 to 15 to 20 emails a day about them.
Right.
Did you two see the article that came out yesterday? They found two additional specimens this spring outside of the small area that they were found last year. So it's likely that they're more established and more widespread than previously thought. So yay.
That was very disappointing news to hear for sure.
Yeah.
Hopefully they can get on top of it. I mean, I think the window is still open for some eradication.
I think it's still contained enough that if they really put an effort in, they could maybe eradicate it. So we'll see what this season brings.
Yep.
I go on their Facebook page, the Washington State Department of Ag. They have a hornet page. And so you don't have to sign up or join, but you can just see what people are saying, what their updates are. And so like they're ready in July for everyone who's interested to put up traps to try to trap some of the workers.
Oh,
so
cool.
They're just telling people to prepare their traps and when to put it out. So it'll be really interesting to see that effort that they have going.
Right now, it's probably all queens that are out trying to establish new nests.
Right. So they're busy and hidden somewhere. So that makes it difficult. The biggest thing I'm getting and that I kind of hate, which I probably should have used for this podcast, except maybe I don't want to, are galls. Galls, galls, galls all the time, guys. Galls.
I love a gall. A gall is a beautiful insect bed and breakfast that it tricks the plant into constructing for it.
Yeah. And it's usually pretty good, easy advice. Like, probably not hurting the plant. You could just let it go.
But galls all the time.
There are a lot of gall questions, particularly with Backyard Farmer. I do remember that being part of that show, was that people see a gall and they send a lot of photographs to that show because the gall does look weird. It looks like a big plant tumor, which it is. And so people are very afraid that something is deathly wrong with their prized oak or what have you. But yeah, it's usually a pretty harmless situation. Maybe we should do a gall show someday.
We should do a gall show because I have been doing a lot of, like, I mean, just the whole gall making aspect. Like, so my sample yesterday wasn't even a sample. I took putty because that's all I had. I didn't have any clay. And to show the audience, like, how actually a gall is formed, like, what it means, like, what is happening and how they look and how they're named. Then I still got three linden galls. I got a plum gall. I got, like, noxious oak gall, oak apple gall. I've had oak bullet gall. Like, it's just gall after gall. And the phone calls yesterday, I had three about gall.
Just ignore it.
Just ignore it. I know. And it's hard to do. So like, oh, there's nothing you can do about it. So I don't know. They're not pretty. You don't get to see any cool insects. They just ruin the trees. Aesthetic.
They
people want
pretty.
A tree for no reason.
They don't. Gall is beautiful. I will die on this hill.
Would you like a bouquet of oak apple gall?
I would love a gall bouquet. Like, if that was an option from 1-800-Flowers, I'd be buying that for myself and tricking people and thinking that I was getting cool gall things shipped to me all the time.
We should do a competition. The most beautiful artistic gall arrangement either as an art form or living form. I don't know. I've seen some pretty cool stuff. I guess I should have used that.
I would just mail you a bunch of nipple galls.
Nipple galls? Bladder galls. Yeah. How about that? Nipple bladder gall?
Yeah. Galls, you know, they're a thing. People talking about them. People wanting to know about them. You looked really excited.
I like galls. I like the idea of a gall show. I'm rolling that around.
We do have a show today. But before we get into the content for today, we do have a shout out that we want to give to a listener who sent an email in. It was a little bit back that he sent the email, but we wanted to do a special shout out in the audio form for him. Listener James Winepress sent us a very kind email, right, Mike?
Yeah, it was really neat. He is a zookeeper up in New York and listens to our show while he's working with the animals. And I was so tickled by that. It's so cool. So thank you for listening.
Yeah, it was really neat to read your email. It actually touched all of our hearts because I think sometimes we're afraid we're just shouting into tin cans for the entertainment of ourselves and no one else. So finding out that somebody with as cool a job as what it sounds like you have is entertained and educated by what we talk about, it really it makes us feel good and happy.
Yeah, he's at the Seneca Park Zoo, and he wanted to thank us for creating a show that's entertaining and educational. So that educational part is good to hear because most of the times we're just entertaining ourselves. So you're welcome, and thank you for listening. He did say he really liked science communication and public outreach, and so you know we will try to put together some shows that will cater to that kind of audience.
Absolutely. I think that today's show is a little bit about science communication, about what we do when we try to talk to people about insects. It can be a fraught process with insects. We've talked a lot about emotions for a few episodes now, and people do have emotional responses to insects, I think. Sometimes they're not always positive, right, Jody?
Yeah, they're mostly on the negative side. I mean, I think it's amazing how emotional people can get about insects. I mean, as emotional passionate we get about insects, people get the reverse equally passionate dislike.
Yeah.
Right? And we get to hear that because we do.
That's our job. We listen to those kinds of problems. Right. I think that we would all agree that in some situations, that response may be mostly appropriate. Like if somebody brings me a bag of bed bugs, a little Ziploc baggie half full of bed bugs, and they're very upset, I'm sympathetic to that and I understand that situation. Wouldn't you as well, Mike?
Oh, yeah. I don't want bed bugs.
So there are times where it seems appropriate, but there are other times where it just seems like people are flat out annoyed by the fact that insects exist. They're bugged by them. Why do you think that is, Jody?
I think it's learned. They've seen other people get bothered by it, so they just think that that's a normal response to it. Mostly it's creepy. It's got too many legs, the way it moves. I actually had someone burn a spider in front of me the other day, and I had to really try hard not to take offense to it because they know how much I love spiders. If you don't like spiders, that's okay. I don't judge.
That's a pretty aggressive move.
It was. They got in a lot of trouble. It was a young person.
How does a young person have a lighter?
Well, she's a teenager. The parent called me and said that we have a spider problem. We may need your help. And I said, I would be happy to help. Get a cup and I will take that spider from you. And when I got there, the teenager was burning it with a lighter. And I said, I was going to take that. And I said, if it's a tiny spider, I could feed it to the Black Widow. And if it was a big spider, I would keep it as a pet. And she just said, I don't like them.
That's reason enough to burn it. Like
and that. I said, that makes me really sad. And then that was it. And that's all I said. And then I text the parent and said, I was here to help, but I think it's managed and it's no longer alive. She wrote a 3-page paper that was actually an excellent paper, and she did some research about some spiders. She talked about peacock spiders and how cool they are, how beautiful they are. She did some research into crab spiders. You know, I'm not saying you have to like everything I like. I just thought it was a little bit mean, and my daughter was right beside me, and she was horrified. She dug deep into like some research about spiders and wrote an apology and a letter about how great spiders are. So it was different, and I felt like we all came out a little bit better.
Except for the spider.
Except for the spider, which, yeah, could have been a good addition to my laundry room.
That sounds kind of like what we're talking about here today. What you want? Is this the genesis of the idea for the show that you came up with?
My number one rule for everything is, like, not to panic, right? Just don't panic. The more you know about an insect, the more you know that these are its behaviors. This is its biology. This is what it eats. This is its habitat. It's not here to come after us. It's not going to make a beeline to our house. And so I get a lot of calls about brown marmorate stink bug because they stink and they're inside. It's a violation of people's privacy. They don't like it. And I get, you know, the conversation and I'm like, you know what? Just don't panic. They actually have been in your house like this whole winter. Sorry about that. And they're just trying to get out. And this is how, you know, this is their biology. This is where they're from. This is actually what kind of pests they are for orchards. And in the fall is when you can start monitoring for them again. So keep your eye out, you know. So I don't know how much that works, but I feel like that education piece is important to be like, oh yeah, that's terrible. They've been spying on you all winter.
Yeah, that's in my head. Like I was thinking of you just being like, no, they've been watching you sleep for months now. Like,
yeah, like the things you can say, right? Like, what are they doing? Well, they're building their homes in your cereal boxes. And when you eat them, then they're in your body. Like, no, they're just coming and eating a little bit of crumbs and taking it back to their nest.
They work for Santa. That's how he knows if you've been naughty or nice, is he's got the marmorated stink bugs to tell him.
Yeah.
So
I don't know.
Can you think of any stories that you might have in your from your line of work that it's been people that have reacted in very, I guess, emotional or exaggerated senses to insects, but you didn't think they didn't need to react so strongly about that particular organism, but that it was a very emotional, creeped out response?
I got an email from a client who sent me photos of some holes in the ground in his lawn and some bees. And he said that he has been spraying these insects, these like ground digging hornets, for years, and he just can't get rid of them. And I lie, well, no, those are ground nesting bees. The photos were blurry, so I couldn't tell what group of ground nesting bees, but it was obvious that they were bees. I explained, like, pollinators are in decline due to these various factors. 70% of the bees in our state are ground nesters, so that's how most of them live. They're really important for spring flowers and for pollination. So like, if you can live with them, it's better to just let them go. And if you can't live with them, if you're, you know, highly allergic to bee stings, which they shouldn't sting you because they're solitary bees, they're not aggressive. But if you do want to get rid of them, like, don't spray them. You're going to have to change something about that area. Like, they're nesting there because they like that soil type and the aspect and the slope and the water. Like, you're gonna have to bring a new soil or change the soil somehow to make it less good for them, and that will be a long-term solution.
Irrigated a bunch or something.
Yeah, hit it with a hose every day for a month to drive them out. Like, you don't have to kill them, you can just make them go somewhere else. And he emailed back, is like, I didn't know they were bees, I'm so sorry, I'm never killing them again, they can stay.
Oh, that's good.
I was like, score one for education. Like, he just didn't know what they were. And once he did and why they're important, he's willing to live with them.
I had the same experience recently on eExtension. Somebody said that they were very afraid of the wasps that were digging in and out of there. They made it sound like it was a flower bed. And the picture they sent, it was very clearly a mining bee. And we walked through the whole thing and they were pleased as punch. They were like, I'm helping bees and I didn't even know it. It was a very touching experience.
Well, that's cool.
That is cool. I think people hate carpenter ants so much too. I don't know why. Just seeing one, I don't know. Maybe that's because in Nebraska, we don't have bald-faced hornets or European hornets or fire ants. So carpenter ants, even more so than termites sometimes, they just can't stand seeing just one ant.
I think ants elicit a very strong response from a lot of folks. I know that when I was in Nebraska, I got inundated every spring with questions about ants, and I still get some of them now in my new role, but it just seems like people are very worried about them. I don't know if it's the fact that they're unionized or something, like they're working together or and they're social, but people don't like ants. I explicitly remember a man that I met in Nebraska that he brought me 4 or 5 ants in a bag. And they were field ants, just, you know, regular old ants. And I said, well, where did you get these? Because he was very panicked about it. He said, I was walking around on my new property and I have a few acres and I found them under a log. And I said, okay. He goes, well, what do I do? And I said, nothing. You're the pest in this situation. Like, you invaded their home. And I didn't actually say that to him, but he was.
You turn back over the log?
He was ready to spray his entire property to try and get rid of these ants that he had just found outside. And when I explained what ants do in the environment, he was more willing to accept them. But the outset, he was afraid of them or upset by them. And needed to hear about what the ants do that's good, I guess.
That's incredible. Like, just that he would buy acreage and then be upset that there's ants, like, over there on the far acreage under a lake.
Yeah.
Like, no, I mean, I've had similar issues with people and ants. Like, I get not wanting ants in your house, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They will destroy the wood and destroy the structure. Like, we get them every year, and I usually have to put a foundation spray of Fipronil down to keep them out of the house because I don't want my rafters being chewed apart. Like, I get that. Mm-hmm. But I had one lady. She got citronella ants, which are subterranean. They farm aphids on plant roots. And so they don't destroy your house. They don't do anything but live in the soil. Occasionally, if you've got like a crack in your foundation or you're on a slab and there's a crack in the slab, they'll come through the cracks and have nuptial flights in the house. People don't like that. And when that happens, it's as easy as just sealing the crack to keep them out, like that, just keep them outside. But this lady, they had a nuptial flight on the outside of her house, like around the foundation. They didn't even come inside. She just didn't like the ants on the outside of her house. Like, they're crawling on my siding. How do I get rid of them? It's like, well, they're not hurting anything. They're just flying around, making new nests. They're not coming inside. They're not going to destroy the house. They're not going to eat anything. Like, it's fine. Just let them go. And she emailed me 3 or 4 times insisting that I tell her what pesticide to use to kill them. And I just kept telling her, like, you don't have to spray them. Just leave them be. If they're not coming in the house, you don't need to worry about it. Even if they are coming in, you don't need a pesticide. You need to do these other things.
I mean, I would tell people definitely to, you know, follow the carpenter to find out if the nest is even in the house. But if they're walking around outside, I guess, cultural sanitation, like where your firewood is, whatnot, but to not be able to sleep for nights and to email me like 30 times about a carpenter ant, I think is a lot.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And I know that we also get other stories, like, I've had people say, what can I do on my property to get rid of cicadas? Because they keep me up at night. I can't sleep because of cicadas. And, you know, there's big questions like that. Like, I can't tell you what to do about cicadas. Like, invite a bunch of cicada killers on your property. You can try, but there's not a lot of help for that.
Well, what gets me about those kind of questions are, like, cicadas fly. Even if you killed every cicada in the ground on your property and in every tree, they'll just come in from the neighbor's property. Like, there's literally nothing to do.
Right. That doesn't stop people, Mike. I think it's interesting how we get questions that are like really philosophical. Like when people are like, well, what is their purpose? Why do they exist? What do you think about them? Or I just want to report how much I hate this. Can you report that somewhere?
I've not gotten as many of those. I know that you've told me about several times where you've gotten emails that start with, I would like to report to you. And I've gotten very few of those, so I don't know why you get that. But I do get the deep philosophical thing. I've had multiple interactions with kids during youth events where they're like, but why? You know, like this big question of, why does the stink bug do that? Or why do they exist? And yeah, even adults, like, what is its purpose? What is its role? I've had, why did God make this? Things like that.
Do you think a lot of that is tied to creationist theology? Like, God made all of these things, therefore they all must have a purpose because they're God ordained.
Yeah.
And you just, like, why do mosquitoes have a purpose? It's like, well, they're just out there doing their thing. They evolved here. They don't have a purpose necessarily. They just are.
I think, like, it has a lot to do with Christian theology, for sure. And I think it has to do with even just like human belief. Like, we want to believe that we all have a role in the world and that we all have a purpose. And I think that we exert that onto the natural world. We try to say, like, well, everything must have a purpose. Everything must have a role. Otherwise, why would it exist? It can't just be because life exists. That's sad and not comforting.
It just leads to, like, well, the universe is uncontrolled chaos and you just do the best you can.
Right. With all these people that we've been talking about, I think those are all interesting, and I think that we've all had to navigate some of those emotions and talk to people and help hopefully convince most of them not to take as extreme of action as they maybe were originally considering. It seems like fire always comes up in situations like that, like what Jody was talking about. But what Jody wanted to talk about today, this sort of emotional response in us, right? Can you kind of give the listeners sort of a primer on what it is that we're chatting about today?
So I wanted the topic to be about, like, what's bugging you. And you, as in you, Mike, and you, Jonathan, and maybe myself. I think a lot of people always want to know, what is the entomologist's favorite bug, or what do you like the least? And so I guess that's what that topic is. Like, what do you like the least? Why is it something you don't particularly care for as an entomologist? What is the reason? And if you stop and you do a little bit more research on that particular organism, can you rethink and reframe your thinking about that particular arthropod? Are there features that this organism has that you don't like? Is there something that if they weren't like that, would you accept? I mean, we get, it's ugly, it's loud, it stinks. So it's different things like that. Like, why doesn't an entomologist like that particular bug? You know, it's going to be a little bit different than, I would say, the general public, maybe.
I would agree with that. I'm willing to kick this thing off and talk about when I was growing up, my least favorite insect, my least favorite arthropod were crickets. I hated crickets. There was a sort of creep factor for me for some reason. I thought that crickets were kind of gnarly organisms, and it was compounded by the fact that one time I was keeping a pet wolf spider, and I'd had it for a couple weeks, and I was like, yeah, this is really dope. I named everything Hiawatha for a while. I don't know why. I think I read it in a Mickey Mouse book as a kid. And so I had Hiawatha the wolf spider, and I put a field cricket in there, and I came back the next day and the cricket had eaten my spider. And I was very angry at this turn of events. I was like, you are prey. You are not predator. And as I've gotten older and gotten more into entomology, I've definitely learned more about cricket biology, and I turned my opinion around on them somewhat because they are omnivores, a lot of them. There are things out there about all the different foods that they eat and the different roles that they play in the environment. I think I even recently saw, Jody, was it you and I that were talking about the Journal of Orthopteran Research?
Yeah.
I was poking around there, and I think I saw something about they were radio labeling cricket feces or grasshopper feces and seeing what ate that in the environment. So they have a cool role to play. And I've also really enjoyed learning about the way that those crickets, the big black ones that we see in the field, that you can actually tell the temperature with their chirps, that there's a mathematical formula that you can use to figure out what the temperature is. If you don't have a thermometer and you have a cricket handy, you can figure it out. We'll post that in the show notes. But I guess that I learned a little bit about them and it changed some of my mind on them. If I had to pick a different one for different reasons, I'd probably go with flies, much to the chagrin of many entomologists, but that for me is just about identification, because usually when I get a fly, it's been squashed, it's been something, masticated in some way, and most people don't seem to be satisfied with like, oh, it's a flesh fly, it's a fruit fly, right. It's a vinegar fly. They want to get it down to species, and I'm like, I ain't got time for wing venation and counting hairs and stuff. So if I were going to pick one for non-creepy reasons, I think it would be my laziness in regards to Diptera identification.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. Those are hard. I just want to be like, yeah, those are flies.
Yep.
But I do. I have an appreciation for them, but I can't ID them.
I need to read McAllister's book and change my opinion on flies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think they're beautiful, some of them. I just can't ID them. Okay, Mike.
So I'm going to riff on that a little bit. So there's no insects that I think of that I dislike, like really strongly dislike the way some of the public do. The only time I can remember being scared of an insect was a client sent me a cockroach, and it was headless in a bag. It was just like the body of a cockroach. And I thought, oh, a dead cockroach. And I put my hand in the bag and it grabbed me. And I shrieked and threw it across the room. And was legitimately like, it was the first time in a long time I've had a jump scare like that. And I, like, my heart was pounding because this apparently dead cockroach was not dead. And like, you know, you sit down and think about it after the shock wears off, like, yes, cockroaches can live for like 30 days without a head. I should not have been surprised.
But you got zombie roached. Like, that's,
I did.
That's creepy.
It was unexpected. You're just like, oh, dead roach in a bag. Like, I mean, how many things do we get dead smash up in a bag? And you're just like, hey, whoa.
Yeah. And it, like, you know, all six legs grabbed onto my finger when I went to grab it, like, freaked me out. No, I don't hate cockroaches after that, but yeah, it was a good jump scare. I think the thing that I'm most annoyed with right now is I have a vinegar fly infestation in my house, and we've had it for about a month. I cannot get rid of them. So there's a really good resource for me, and John, you may be able to use it. It should apply to most of the vinegar flies you'll get. Jody, maybe not so much for you, but it's a pictorial key to vinegar flies of the northeastern United States. And it turns out vinegar flies, super easy to ID if you've got a key. Under the microscope, they're all really distinctive, and the characters are relatively easy. So I have Drosophila funebris in my house. They're recorded from compost and decaying plant material, some other things. The advice that I give clients is, you've got to find what they're breeding in and eliminate the breeding habitat, because otherwise you'll just keep producing adult flies. You can trap all the adult flies you want, but if there's still larvae breeding in something, you just keep getting adult flies. I cannot for the life of me figure out what they're breeding in.
Do you see them in the kitchen mostly?
No, they're in my bathroom.
I already asked him if he had a loose potato somewhere.
Yeah.
Did you lose a potato somewhere in those pipes?
The only trap? Thing I can figure out is they're in the pipes or the trap, but I've scrubbed those out and poured boiling water down there.
Because, like, are they coming out of the drain? Have you put anything over it to see if, like, they'll come up and you catch them on tape and stuff?
I haven't. That's a good idea. Like, it's the bathroom that we use all the time. So I guess I could do it for maybe an hour or two and just have everybody, like, hold their pee.
Just put an outhouse out back.
Yeah.
That'll get you a different kind of fly problem, though.
It's true. So I've just got vinegar traps and red wine traps in the couple rooms that they're really bad in, and just try to keep the adult population down for now. And I'm hoping that they just devour whatever it is they're devouring and then peter out. It's terrible advice for an entomologist to not take his own advice.
I told you about infesting my office, right? Like, I have been there.
Yeah, tell listeners about that. This is amazing.
Well, I don't know if it's amazing. I would call this an entomologist fail. But I was going to do an educational segment. Actually, I did do an educational segment about the India male moth. And I paid $3.60 for a peanut stacker, which is some type of bird food. I bought it because I saw an India male moth larvae in it. Did a segment on TV about pantry moths, and then I put it in a container. You know, it wasn't totally airtight. And then I put a pantry moth pheromone trap. So my thinking was, if they came out of the packaging and pupated, the moths would get stuck to the pheromone trap. And yeah, all was good for a while. I would probably check on it every day. And then we went into quarantine, and I hadn't been back to my office in, what, like 9 weeks. And so I went the other day to pick up some wasp nest to take on TV. And I opened up my little cupboard in my office, and out flew moths at my face. And I was like, oh, bad word. And then I made sure my office door, personal office door, was shut, killed with my hands the moths that were flying around. And then I knew exactly what I had to do, because it's like what we give advice to our clients. Yeah, 3-4 hours later, I'm hoping that things have been taken care of. But I infested my personal office and cupboard with India male moth larvae and adults. Pheromone traps are going to probably catch the males, right? Because it's a sex pheromone. And it's hoping, before they mate. But there were larvae everywhere, and there were webbing everywhere, and they like to come out of the product, and so they chewed out of the container, and then they went up, and there was webbing in all the shelving, in all the corrugated cardboard that was holding business cards or whatnot. I had larvae trying to pupate on the sides of display boxes. It was everywhere. I mean, it was an extensive cleaning process. I had to throw away a lot of packaging. I had to wrap everything in trash bags and took the whole thing out to the dumpster. I had to clean out the freezer full of bug samples and put some of the things I had in that cupboard. It was bad. It was a bad thing for an entomologist to do. It was very bad.
It's not, I mean, it sounds like it was a nice experience. You got to live through what maybe some of your clients have gone through.
Yeah. I mean, but Jonathan, you worked there. I mean, we've got nutritionists. We have food scientists. We have a lot of products there. Like, if I would have had my office door open, I mean, I could have infested the whole entire office.
Here's the thing. Well, though, I mean, like, they've all infested the office at various times with stuff, too. So, you know, they can't throw stones. I can't tell you how many times I had to go through and clean up people's vinegar fly problems and the wasps that randomly got into the back room and everything. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, it sounds like an experience for sure. I think that of the three of us, Jody had kind of cooked up the best of the what bugs you stories, though. You had kind of you had hinted at it, and I think it begins with earwigs. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I grew up in Ontario, Canada, and I never saw earwigs when I was younger at my house. I grew up in Kitchener. But I would stay all the summers in a place called Oakville by a lake with my cousin every summer, and I taught at a science camp. I never thought I was going to be an entomologist. I liked bugs, but it was not like no biggie. But her house was, I would say at this time, now I wouldn't say it was infested, but back then it was infested with earwigs. And it was this one bathroom that we would share. So I would stay there. We would sleep, you know, my cousin, we would sleep in a bedroom attached to this bathroom, and partially it was underground. So it was a very like damp, dark area. But at night, we would go, like, nobody wanted to go to the bathroom at night. But when you go in there, there were earwigs crawling on the counters, crawling up the walls, in the shower. Like, if you were washing your hair, you would have like earwigs like coming out of the places. I don't know, on the shower. It was everywhere. So this is how I thought, right? And after a while, I remember just thinking, like, no, like, this is not going to stop us. Like, we need to fight back against these earwigs. And then I got a jar and I started collecting them, and I would just collect them. Anyone who was there, because like if you caught them or killed them, they would just keep coming back. And you just kept thinking, is this the same one? Is it like this reincarnated earwig? No, I want to know how many there are actually in this place. And so I started collecting them, and we would get like, I don't know, 30 of them. And even the jar in the on the counter, I would turn on the light and there would be earwigs looking at the earwigs in the jars. And I would be like, ew.
Mother,
even like where you would lock the door, like you would lock the door for the bathroom and you would, you know, move the little thing into the hole in the wall and an earwig would come out, like all the cracks and crevices. But I didn't know that's what earwigs did. So that was my memory. And I wanted to check with my cousin. So, you know, last week I emailed her and I said, hey, I want to tell this story about earwigs when we were growing up, but I don't even know if what I remember is true. Can you tell me about your experience with earwig? So she sent me this. So I dislike earwigs. They're incredibly unattractive insects. Their giant pinchers are nightmarish and they look like something out of a horror movie. Two, I recall from my childhood feeling as though these creatures were lurking everywhere, in every crevice, under every dish on the countertop, every shampoo container in the bathrooms, waiting to dart away or worse toward me every time I disturbed their hiding spots. I remember one particular incident when I was in grade school. I was getting my lunch ready for school and I poured some milk into a thermos that had been sitting open on the counter. At lunchtime, I drank some milk from the thermos and immediately felt a small object in my mouth. I spit my milk back into my thermos, and there floating dead in the milk was an earwig, its pinchers gleaming wet. I was so repulsed, I couldn't eat the rest of my lunch. And so that's my sweet cousin, me living with her for summers, like that transferred to me. And I was like, yeah, I don't like earwigs. Probably when the pest management started in me, I actually wrote her back after she sent that to me. And I said, do you think it's funny that I became an entomologist? And she said, yeah, absolutely.
That description is poetic, gleaming in the milk light or whatever. Like,
yeah, so that's what she sent me. And I did a little bit of research on earwigs. But, you know, since I've become an entomologist, I'm more fascinated by them. I like seeing them. There's just so many cool things about them. And of course, like, Dr. Rebecca Schmidt Jeffers is like all about earwigs. And so I think about her, and she's taught me really how to appreciate them as like biocontrol in some situations, not all situations, but in an orchard.
I'm going to bring that up because that's like very new thinking. Like, everybody's always tried to control them because they do eat a little bit of leaf material, but they make more aphids than they damage the plants.
Right. I mean, in some cases, not so much like when it comes to stone fruits, but in some situations, they're going to be beneficial. And then if you look at them, like they're just so weird looking with their giant cerci at the back, their pincers, you know, the curvedness if they're males, and then if they're straight, they're females, but then how they use that, you know, either for fighting or for mating, and then their wings are all folded up in this cool origami way. Like they are really cool and fascinating. So I don't hate them, but that experience, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I should try on my cousin. I'll send her all these things and maybe do a video on like how great they are and see if she could still say, yeah, that happened to me as a child, but I can appreciate them now. Who knows?
Well, I think yours is a very interesting story because it's kind of like two paths diverged in an earwig wood. Like you went down the path of what is this and how could I be interested? And she had a different experience. She clearly went down the path of like, I hate this and it's gross. And maybe that's what's different about us as entomologists versus our non-entomology brethren out there and friends that are out there.
Right.
I've had an adversarial role with earwigs before.
I was going to say, John, you've certainly got an earwig story.
When I was a were we freshmen?
Freshmen or sophomores. Yeah. We were undergrad.
I think we were in 300, so it must have been freshmen. We were in a class at Purdue, and we were making our collection that we needed to turn in. And I remember Dr. Oseto was setting us up to go outside. And he was like, and today you'll probably find some earwigs. And earwigs are great. Earwigs do this. This is what they look like. Here's how you identify them. They have these big cerci. People are always afraid of the cerci. Don't be afraid of the cerci. They don't do anything. You remember, like, it was all set up.
Yeah. This is the spiel we got.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid of the cerci.
Don't be afraid of the cerci. And we went outside. And did we pop a log open or – there was wood involved.
Spark of something.
Yeah. And there were dozens of earwigs. And he was standing there and he was like, get at him, Larson. Like, get everybody an earwig. And so I reached my hand into this mass of earwigs just to like bear scoop them out, like Winnie the Pooh style, and give one to everybody. And one of them got a hold of the tip of my thumb with its cerci and it pierced me and it drew blood. And I was like, yowza! And yanked my hand away. I think that's what I said because it was the 1950s. I pulled my hand out and like flung my thumb around trying to get it off, but it was clamped on pretty hard. I had to like pull it apart and throw it. And when I say drew blood, I mean like there was like four drops of blood. But Dr. Oseto lost his mind and thought this was the greatest thing that had ever happened in the history of higher education. And last I heard, he still talks about it anonymously. He doesn't use my name, but he talks about, oh, you got to be careful with the earwigs. Do not fear them. But I once had a student who lost blood to their butt pinchers.
To be fair, it was a very large male earwig. But yeah, Sarah was in that class after we left, and he was still telling that story.
I'm glad to be a part of the tradition.
Yeah, you should tell him you want to be cited.
Larson, 2005 says.
These things are...
And maybe like the whole earwig thing, like just that they were called earwigs and I didn't know anything about them kind of implies that they're going to go into your ear. That's very scary. So if I could rename my disliked insect, I would call it origami wings.
That's a good one.
Ooh.
Yeah, because their scientific family name is also not great. Isn't it skin?
Yeah.
Wing?
Dermaptra.
Yeah. Also kind of creepy.
I never thought about spraying anything. I mean, I was a teenager, but it was just like, I'm going to get these guys. I want to know more about them. Like, it was just my brain. I'm going to collect them. And so I'm still that way, right? You see these, like, I want to see it. When someone sends a picture of eggs, I'm like, ooh, do you have those? Can I rear those out? Like, I want to know what they are. I don't want to just pretend I know what they are because I can say that they're probably some type of muff egg, but I don't really know. And I want to see. I don't know. Maybe that's what makes our brains different.
I don't know if it makes us different necessarily, but I do think that it's sort of an opportunity. You can kind of like ride the lightning if there's this moment of inspiration, or there's a moment of opportunity, and it can be inspiration for fascination or for fear. And I think that we're in a unique opportunity, the three of us in our jobs, where we are with people at that moment and we can steer them in one direction or push them in the other. Not to sound like a Jedi or anything, but I think that it is a moment. It's a teachable moment. We hear that phrase a lot. And if you teach somebody something, maybe they'll remember it and maybe they'll feel differently in the future about whatever it is that they've been talking to you about. Just like with all these hornets that we've been getting, like all the explanations that we've passed out and tried to teach people about, it clearly strikes a chord with some of them. I guess we just have to be careful, like we're raising entomologists or something. But I think that we've all shared some pretty good stories here today. I had a lot of fun hearing everything and getting to share. And I appreciated your cousin's email. That was a really funny one to hear, Jody.
Yeah, I don't want to drink an earwig. That sounds absolutely gross.
Earwigs, right, and it's like in your mouth.
They have a smell to them. Like, I don't want that in my mouth.
Like, they just seem greasy.
Reminds me of when Greg Pass talked about the stink bug tea that his roommate
had. Yeah. Yep. That sounds gross too.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed hearing our stories here today. If you've got one that you'd like to share, you can send it to us on Twitter. The show is arthro_podshow. And you can find each of us individually on Twitter. I'm at Bugman John.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And I'm at mscavarla36.
So hit us up on there. Let us know what you think. Or send us an email if you'd like, just like James did. We always love hearing from our listeners. We love your stories. We love hearing what you think of the show. And if you've got any ideas for future episodes that we can do, we also appreciate those. So thanks for tuning in. And look forward to another episode here in a couple of weeks of Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
Some interesting
time out.
Okay.
We should do the shout out.
Oh, I was going to do it at the end, but do you want to do it now?
Okay, time back in. Never mind.
She's like Zach Morris from Saved by the Bell or something. Like, time out, man. Time back in, dude.